Exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week in Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to first summarize some of the top stories in science. Leading off, our top story concerns journalists for the first time are allowed into the Fukushima nuclear disaster site, and they are shocked. They are shocked by the sheer magnitude of the destruction and devastation at the Fukushima site, and also the reporters were briefed on a blow-by-blow autopsy of what actually happened in the nuclear disaster, and they again were shocked once more. Also, 2 weeks ago, an asteroid skimmed right overhead, YU-55. Thousands of astronomers from around the world, most of them amateurs, gathered outside with their telescopes to observe the closest encounter we've had in memory with another celestial body, an asteroid that was 1,300 feet away. And in the last 2 weeks, scientists have issued a bonanza of scientific data from that sighting. And this could have implications for the Obama space program because it's projected that the United States may even send a rocket probe to visit an asteroid in the coming decades. And also on the medical front, it turns out that heart disease may have one more way of bringing it under control, and this time using stem cell technology. It's almost like science fiction. Today, if you have heart disease, well, there's really not that much people can do about it except get exercise, change your lifestyle, get a triple bypass, get a stent. However, what about growing new heart tissue directly? That would wipe out all previous medical interventions, and for the first time, there is new hope. New hope using stem cells for heart attack patients. And also diabetes. Diabetes may not be as sensational as cancer, but it's projected that by 2030, 10% of the entire human population could come down with diabetes. And that figure was calculated without taking into account obesity. When you take that figure into account, you begin to have the staggering figure that a large chunk of the adult population of the planet Earth could come down with diabetes. And then we're going to bring on our special guest today. We're very glad to have with us Professor Peter Ward. He's a professor of biology at the University of Washington in Seattle, but he's also the author of a controversial book called Flooded Earth. In other words, we can talk till we're blue in the face about global warming, but what does it mean about you? Given the fact that about 50% of most people in the industrialized nations live near a city, what does it mean if you live in a flooded earth? What does it mean if New York City has to have dikes around it? What happens when New Orleans goes completely underwater? What happens when we kiss goodbye to the great city of Venice? Well, these are some of the legacies that we're going to be leaving our children. And not to mention at Christmas time, kids will know that Santa Claus is a myth because Santa Claus lives in the North Pole. And in the future, kids will be so smart, they'll know there is no more North Pole, because we adults messed it up. Well, these are some of the things that we will discuss today with Professor Peter Ward, author of a new book called Flooded Earth. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. It's been 9 months, 9 months now since the Fukushima disaster riveted the world's attention, and for the first time, reporters from around the world were allowed right into the reactor site to see firsthand the enormous devastation, and they were shocked. Reporter after reporter said that their jaws just hit the floor when they saw the massive devastation surrounding them. And remember, this is a nuclear power plant. It's not a Hollywood movie set. is a nuclear power plant that contained vast amounts of uranium. And then here was this junkyard that the reporters saw. First, the reporters saw the devastation caused by not one, not two, not three, but four hydrogen gas explosions, which blew the roof right off these reactor sites. An amazing sight in and of itself. And then the debris. Everywhere they looked, there was debris. And of course, there were some areas still that the reporters could not report from because they were simply too radioactive. In fact, the reporters had to wear all sorts of protective gear to make sure they didn't get radioactive cesium in their nostrils, into their ear, into their hair. Because cesium-137 has a half-life of about 30 years, meaning it's radioactive and dangerous for perhaps 300 years. Long after you're dead and buried, your gravesite will still be radioactive, complements of the Fukushima reactor. Then the journalists were given a blow-by-blow breakdown of what happened right after the tsunami hit Japan, and it was a nightmare. In fact, it was a folly of errors made by the reactor operators because they were going blind because they didn't know what they were doing. It's now known that just within the first few hours of the accident, when all power was shut down, when backup generators ceased to function, and water levels began to drop because of the overheating of the steam, well, at that point, the core was completely uncovered. Completely, 100% uncovered, without any cooling water at all. The core began to melt into a puddle of uranium. It only took a few hours for that to happen. We've never seen this before. For the first time in nuclear history, we've actually witnessed a nuclear power core, 100 tons of uranium dioxide, being reduced to a puddle of molten uranium. We've never seen this before. And then the puddle just kept right on burrowing through the reactor vessel and drilled a hole, perhaps 2 inches across. All this molten uranium then fell onto the very bottom of the containment structure. And units 2, units 3 were also following suit, something we had never seen before. 100% core melt, liquefaction of an entire core. Not one, but two, three cores. Amazing. And then the question was, how come we didn't lose northern Japan? By rights, we should have had a steam explosion, which then would have ripped apart whatever was left of the containment structure, releasing nuclear fuel right into the atmosphere over Japan, creating a nightmare beyond comprehension. What happened? Why were they able to bring it under control? And the answer is, as we now know, one worker disobeyed orders. He was under strict orders not to allow seawater into the core because that would damage the reactors permanently, and TEPCO, the utility, still hoped that they could salvage these reactors even after this devastating accident. Well, the reactor operator knew the obvious. It was an accident spiraling out of control. He disobeyed orders, and flooded all three with seawater. We now know that was the only correct decision made in the first day of the accident. The only correct decision which saved northern Japan from being wiped out by not one, but three simultaneous meltdowns. And reporters were gasping, realizing how close we came to a complete devastation, even as TEPCO and the government were kept saying that everything's under control. We now know how close we came to a full-scale tragedy. And then, if you are an amateur astronomer, 2 weeks ago, you probably took your telescope out there in the night to look for an asteroid, YU-55, that whizzed right overhead. In fact, it was so close, it whizzed right underneath the orbit of the moon. It came within the orbit of the moon, and it was a first. Now, this is not the first time we've had gigantic asteroids whiz by the Earth. That's happened since time immemorial. This is the first time that we had advance notice of this, because back in 2005, an astronomer correctly identified this asteroid, and then they could use computers to plot its trajectory, and then they realized, bingo, it was scheduled for a near miss. If you missed this event, if you did not bring your telescope out there to observe this once-in-a-lifetime event, Then, no problem, perhaps in another 30, another 50 years, you'll have another try to look at an asteroid that literally whizzes right overhead. And then the question is, what impact does that have on the space program? Well, potentially a lot. Data is now coming out. Data is now being processed of that close encounter. So it was just as if we had sent a space probe into outer space to fly by an asteroid. That's important because President Barack Obama has canceled the space shuttle, canceled the moon program, canceled the gigantic booster rocket that was going to take us to the moon, but has left open the option that we may visit an asteroid in the future. And this close encounter could answer a lot of questions. For example, what happens if you whiz by an asteroid and it's not solid? It's nothing but a loose collection of dirt and rocks held together by gravity. Then, of course, you can't land on that asteroid at all. And then now on the medical front. Stem cell technology, well, people have talked about it for years, but it hasn't delivered yet. Now we have the first tangible result that stem cell technology could one day revolutionize the way we treat heart disease patients. If you suffer from heart disease, well, you can always exercise, have a better diet. Then you could perhaps have a stent placed inside your blood vessels. A stent is basically a wire cage that forces open that blood vessel. Perhaps you can have a triple bypass. Look what happened to President Clinton. Or, in the future, you will have yet another option. Stem cell technology to grow new heart tissue from scratch. Well, this is making the news. 16 patients. 16 patients were given stem cell technology at the University of Louisville. And the results were dramatic. Dramatic. It turns out that the blood pumping efficiency of these individuals was rather low, about 30%. But after the treatment, it jumped up to almost 40% efficiency. And then 7 patients who underwent MRI testing, they calculated that the amount of dead muscle tissue decreased. That's right, the amount of discardable waste dead heart tissue decreased by 24% over 4 months and 30% over a year. Now, the patients who did not get stem cell treatment, they registered no improvement whatsoever. And if you read the case studies, it's even more impressive. For example, one individual got the treatment in 2009 and got extra years of life, because the doctors beforehand said that he had very little chance of surviving with such a damaged heart. Another individual had to always take nitroglycerin tablets for chest pain. Then he'd have to lie down for a few minutes until the chest pain went away. That was this person's lifestyle until he had stem cell technology applied to his heart. And now, get this, now it doesn't happen anymore. He doesn't need the nitroglycerin. It's as if the guy could simply throw away his medicine. So again, more testing has to be done, but this is very tantalizing news, growing new heart tissue directly from stem cells. Now, we know that we can grow tissue that doesn't have that many blood vessels and is rather simple without stem cells. At the present time, using plastic molds, scientists can create skin, bone, cartilage, noses, ears, blood vessels, heart valves, bladders, and the first windpipe. However, this method of using a mold to grow tissue is only effective if the tissue doesn't have that many heart valves. It turns out that the heart tissue here that we're talking about has lots of blood vessels. Therefore, you need stem cells, and that's where this study comes in. Using stem cell technology, they were able to literally grow new healthy heart tissue. And also on the medical front, you probably heard about this, and that is obesity. Obesity is one thing that will perhaps drive up the rate of diabetes and a whole host of other diseases. But here's another study coming out. This study looked at diabetes in the year 2030. Even without looking at obesity, they just looked at adult onset type 2 diabetes. They found that 10%, fully 10% of the adult population of the earth will have type 2 diabetes by 2030. Then if you factor in obesity, that number jumps even higher. The point raised by this study is very simple. This could break the bank. How are we going to take care of 10% of all adults worldwide that come down with type 2 diabetes? And then on top of that, obesity also adds to the ranks of diabetics. How are we going to pay for it? This could break the bank. This could be one of the great medical emergencies of the future when we're in a situation where we have to treat a good fraction of all adults on the planet Earth. That's why this study said, in conclusion, that we have to exercise preventive medicine. It means first we have to rein in all the sugar and all the animal fat in our diet that makes our bodies bloat, that floods our body with sugar, and that stresses the diabetic system. Insulin, as a consequence, becomes less effective if the body is flooded with sugar all the time, and also animal fat clogs up the heart. We're talking about a medical emergency, say the doctor, since his report, by 2030. It means we're going to have to take emergency measures to bring this under control, or else we will literally go bankrupt. In some sense, we are eating ourselves to death. Eating ourselves with animal fat, gorging ourselves with fat, drinking it, washing it down with sugar, that's not the way the human body was constructed. In fact, my theory is the caveman principle. You realize that our body was crafted by evolution so that cavemen and women, thousands of years ago, could function ideally in that environment. Look at how our ancestors lived. They lived on a low-fat diet, low-sugar diet, plenty of fruits, berries, and roughage, lots of exercise, strong social bonding. In fact, that's a prescription for long life. Who are the longest living peoples on the earth? Well, the Okinawans. And scientists who study the Okinawans find the same thing in other populations that also have long-lived individuals. Low-fat diet, low-sugar diet, plenty of exercise, strong social contact with other people. These are the four ingredients for the fountain of youth. If you want to know how to stay young, vigorous, and live longer and enjoy it, follow the conclusions of numerous studies done on Okinawans and other long-lived individuals. They know that they can seize control over their own lifespan. I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. He's Professor Peter Ward. He's a professor of biology and earth and space science at the University of Washington in Seattle. The book is rather disturbing and is hitting the bookshelves this week. The book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. Now, on exploration, of course, we've had programs about global warming. We've talked about the effect on population and on agriculture and on tropical diseases. But here's a book that talks specifically about how our cities, some of our major cities, will go underwater or may have to be abandoned because of global warming. The book is controversial. However, it gives you a frame of reference as to what scientists are thinking if sea levels continue to rise, not 1 foot, 2 foot, but 5, 6, 7, 8 feet above normal. What happens to our great cities? What about warfare between nations when national borders begin to collapse because of mass migrations of hundreds of millions of people? Something to think about. Once again, the book is called The Flooded Earth.
Much more fun project I've been in, Rare Earth with Don Brownlee. I'd rather do astrobiology.
Oh, but well, I actually interviewed you, either you or Brownlee, I forgot.
Yeah, you did. It just seems to be a happier topic to me to put my head in the sand, but unfortunately, I don't think we can do that much more.
Yeah, I don't think so either. Okay, well, the engineer gave us the go-ahead, so let's start with the first question. Oh, the first question that we always ask our guests is, how did you, as a youth now, get interested in science? So I'll lead off with that question. So, dig back to the cobwebs and think about what it was as a child that set you off in the direction of science. Okay, so the engineer said we're going to start in 10 seconds with that first question about you as a youth. Professor Ward, you're a professor of biology and Earth and space science at the University of Washington in Seattle. However, as a youth, what steered you in the direction of science?
Well, thanks so much for having me. And I think scientists know from an early age that they're going to be scientists, so it was indeed youth. What got me going were dinosaurs. My mother and father were from New York. I grew up in Seattle. We didn't have a single dinosaur skeleton, and so I was given this guilt treatment that I had to be in Seattle, and it's my fault or something that there were no dinosaur skeletons, but that got me going.
Okay, and that set you off, and how did you get interested in astronomy and Earth and space science?
Well, I certainly started in paleontology, so I was looking at my feet all the time down at the ground. But it became evident, I think, in the first part of this century, or really the end of the 20th century, that there was a great deal to learn about life in space and especially how other Earths could be constructed from what we knew in our own Earth history. And so deep Earth history can inform us about astrobiology. And in the book I've just done now, it is deep Earth history, which can inform us about what climate change is capable of.
Okay, well, the book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. So let's start with the ice caps. The North Polar region, over the past 50 years, since submarines have visited the North Pole, seems to have decreased by 50% just in the last 50 years. So what is your projection of the North Pole and also Greenland going into the future?
Well, the great dream of the Europeans coming to North America was for the Northwest Passage. I mean, this was a driving impulse to try to find a quick trade route to China. We're going to have that. But what really I really didn't understand thoroughly enough was the difference between an ice cap and an ice sheet. All of the North Polar ice cap can melt away, and it will have no effect, essentially, on sea level. It is the ice on land, the ice sheets, which are the biggest of which, of course, are Greenland and in Antarctica. Anything that melts on those goes directly into the ocean and raises the level of it. And the biggest, scariest scenario is equivalent to what we call an ice sheet collapse. So imagine you have a cup of really warm water and then dump in about 10 or 15 ice cubes. And up goes the level of that water really fast. Well, that is the scenario for a ice sheet collapse in Antarctica.
Okay, well, we've heard about what's happening in the North Polar region, but in the South Pole, we have huge chunks of ice breaking off. But what does that mean, given the fact that most of the South Pole seems stable, at least temporarily?
You know, I've come back from two separate trips to Antarctica over the last 2 years, and we're looking at deep time events of the climate down there, but you can't help but notice what's going on all around you. It was melting like crazy. When you have both kinds of ice down there. You've got floating ice, which, again, if that melts, doesn't matter. But you've also got all this ice on land. When it melts, the water goes down to the ice rock contact, of course, and that acts as a lubricant. So when you have really anomalous warming, stuff that is on the edge of this can calve off into the ocean. That causes great global change in terms of sea level rise.
Okay, and talking about sea level rise, doesn't the heating of the Earth itself cause expansion of warm water, which causes the sea level to rise? Just the sheer fact that the Earth is warming up.
It sure does. And matter of fact, if we stopped all emissions right now, we just went completely emission neutral, the ocean is still going to rise in its level because of thermal expansion. There's been so much warming already that the ocean has a lag effect, but over the next 40, 50 years, we could expect nearly a 3-foot sea level rise if, based on the temperatures that we have now and the continued warming, just from the thermal expansion, no ice at all.
Okay, 3-foot rise without any ice, and I guess for every 1-foot vertical that you lose, how much horizontal seacoast do you lose?
Well, the seacoast itself is affected more strongly by storm surge. And you think of storm surge as equivalent to going off a diving board. You jump off a diving board at a given height, but if you bounce a couple of times, you go way higher. It's as if you have a launching platform as sea level rises. The storm surge, which are the nasty big waves that rise higher than normal sea level, can hit coasts. But the sideways movement of the ocean is far more serious in terms of what its salt does. Salt goes laterally quite easily, and depending on the type of soil, it is the salinization of the sea level crops that I think is the greatest single danger from sea level rise. It's stunning how much of the world's productivity, and especially the rice regions in Southeast Asia, are on deltas. A delta is built out from a river hitting a calm ocean. If you have a 3-foot sea level rise, every delta on this planet will disappear. We're talking about the Nile, the Brahmaputra, the Mekong, and these are all enormously productive areas. So this is the big blow that is coming. The equation is we're going to have a rise in sea level at the same time we have a rise in human population. As you know, we're at 6.6 billion now, but we're heading towards 9 billion. And this, too, is built into the system. It's kind of like the warmth of the ocean. We could do tremendous birth control efforts now, but we're probably still going to hit that 9 billion. So the intersection of 9 billion with reduced agricultural yields because of the sea level rise is the scariest aspect.
Okay, well, let's assume that we do nothing. That is, we simply treat everything as normal. We keep on spewing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Let's take the world 2050. In 2050, what will coastal cities like Boston, New York, Miami, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, what will they look like if we just keep spewing carbon dioxide in the air as if there was nothing wrong, and we project 50 years into the future?
Well, 2050 is still not going to be apparent that we're in a crisis. It's kind of like watching a speed car as it leaves the Indy 500. If you catch it in the first 10 feet or so, it's not going very fast. But acceleration is an interesting thing. It will be apparent to all city planners in 2050 that something new is going on, and they won't like it. Much of city infrastructure is now buried. People put down obviously all the sewage, but now so much of the electrical and advanced communication systems are underground. They were not engineered for salt water. They were engineered for fresh water. Bringing a lot of salt into city infrastructure is going to be a huge headache. It's also going to be a headache for trying to keep freshwater reservoirs going and freshwater aquifers. So 2050 is the time when the alarm bells are going to be ringing. The populace isn't going to see much. It might only be a foot rise by then, but certainly there will be urban red lights going off like crazy.
Well, that completes the first part of our interview with Professor Peter Ward, Professor of Biology at the University of Washington in Seattle. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. And once again, you may also want to pick up a copy of my latest book. It's called Physics of the Future, 5 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. In fact, it was among the top 10 books, the top 10 nonfiction books sold in the United States of America. And it was the number one science book in this country, Physics of the Future. Get a copy. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we brought on Dr. Peter Ward of the University of Washington at Seattle, author of an explosive new book hitting the stands right now, even as we speak. The book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. So what would it be like in a world where we lose Venice, we lose Miami, we lose Bangladesh, we lose the Mekong Delta? What happens when perhaps nuclear weapons are used to prevent mass migrations, which will inevitably happen as entire nations become flooded? And realize that 50% or so of the world's population lives next to the ocean, many of them in megacities. What happens when some of them go underwater? So once again, the book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. Think about it, and then ask yourself a question. How far are you from the ocean, and what is your height above sea level? Well, in New York City, a few years ago, we had a gigantic nor'easter which sent a surge of water into Manhattan, which flooded the subway system. And it was not even a very big storm that did that. And some people think that storm surges, even before sea level rise goes to catastrophic levels, storm surges could paralyze the electrical, the plumbing system, and the infrastructure of a city. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, storm surge is definitely the most dangerous short-term effect of this. Look, we saw what storm surge did to New Orleans. It wasn't so much the hurricane itself, Katrina, that battered New Orleans. It was the storm surge. And once again, your storm surge comes from a mean sea level. When you keep raising that mean sea level, storm surge goes up, way up, higher. The most endangered creatures are therefore freshwater plants. And what I'm really breaking my heart is trying to think what's going to happen to the Everglades. You've got this enormous freshwater biosystem, which will be so threatened by both storm surge and simply rise in sea level. You cannot live in salt water if you're a freshwater plant. And unfortunately, no saltwater plant, like a mangrove, makes food that humans can eat.
Something to think about. Now let's turn the wheels of time to 2100. What will the great cities of the world look like in 2100?
Well, 2100, there will be 3 feet, only 3 feet if we're lucky, and 5 to 6 feet if we're not lucky. And by lucky, I mean we turn off the lights right now. If it is business as usual, and I suspect it might be because of the increased population numbers, there will be that 3 to 5 foot. The most hard hit will be the wharves. Global transport by ship is still the main means of moving great amounts of food around. CNN projected when I was in Antarctica a few months ago that even a 1 foot rise in sea level will cause shipping terminals and ports and docks and dock heights to have to be modified. And their projection was $1 trillion or more by about 2040 just to spend on the docks. Now, San Francisco Airport, I've landed on that airport over and over and over. A 3 to 5 foot sea level rise in the Bay Area will remove that airport entirely. And so just from the economic points of view, that 3 to 5 foot sea level is going to cause such an enormous financial burden on coastal cities.
Okay, the big question, will cities have to be abandoned if sea levels continue to rise 3 to 5 feet, and which cities are we talking about?
Well, we've done a lot of projections on this, and I've been talking to some Dutch engineers. The consensus, and again, this is really just consensus of people looking forward, is that civilization and the cities now could probably absorb a 3 foot, 4 foot, even at the worst case scenario, a 5 foot sea level rise, and survive. But anything above 5 to 6 feet for a lot of cities is not survivable. New York has high ground. It can simply move back. But Miami cannot. Miami is, I think, the poster child of the type of city that will disappear, as Galveston, Texas will, much of the South Florida cities will. And the Netherlands, of course, is in huge trouble. They already have a significant, I think 30% of the land area is already under sea level. And they spend an appreciable amount of their GNP on dikes every year, dikes and the equivalent of dikes, sometimes big sandbars. When the global economy gets hit hard, it affects everybody, and I think that's what's coming.
Well, what about Boston? Large parts of Boston were reclaimed since the Revolutionary War. If you look at old maps of Boston, large parts of Boston didn't exist until recently. So what's going to happen to Boston?
Yeah, all reclaimed parts of cities are going to go away. The same with my city of Seattle. Our entire bay, Elliott Bay it's called, there's an island. Our major shipping port is an island built up from reclaimed sediment, just as Boston is. And once again, the 3-foot sea level rise allows storm surge, the big storms, to come whipping in and remove a lot of that sediment. You're not going to be able to hold that together. So any city with reclaimed sediment construction, and lots of the airports in Asia, and especially in Japan, they've been building airports out on the water. China's just done it too. All those things will have to be rebuilt somewhere else.
And what about San Francisco, Los Angeles, and especially what's going to happen to New Orleans, where large parts of the city are actually under sea level?
I think New Orleans will have to be abandoned ultimately. It might be a century or two. San Francisco is very interesting. They're very progressive engineers down there, and believe it or not, they have a plan for building a dam right under the Golden Gate Bridge that would save every one of the Bay cities. You could hold off sea level rise by building this dam. Otherwise, it's going to be a whole series of smaller dikes and systems and try to save what you can and lose what otherwise. Los Angeles is in an interesting position, too, because the city itself has obviously a lot of high ground, but there are very low-lying areas in Los Angeles that, again, will be inundated to the point that some huge storm comes, salt water is pushed way inland through storm surge, killing off the plants that are there. And then what do you do when you're living in a house that is flooded out by not freshwater, salt water? A saltwater flooding event is way worse than a freshwater flooding event.
And what about London, where we have gigantic underwater devices to help control the water of the Thames River? Are we all going to be like that? Are we all going to be like the little Dutch boy putting our finger in gigantic dikes that we're going to build around our cities? What are we going to do about this?
Well, the British have thought a lot about sea level rise, too, and they are planning on contingencies for up to 5 feet. And you just really hit it. They're thinking about what sort of engineering do we have to do to save our cities. Historic cities, such as London and any of the cities in the Mediterranean, will do everything and anything to try to keep their shorelines as they are now. But it really all depends on where we can stop this. Look, if we melt every single glacier on the planet, we have a sea level rise of over 200 feet. That was the case less than 17,000 years ago. We know from the deep past that when carbon dioxide has been 1,000 parts per million, there is no ice sheet. And we're at 380, 390 and climbing. It's just that to me is the spookiest aspect of it all.
Okay, and what's going to happen to growing areas of the world? Like California has the San Joaquin Valley. Other places have gigantic growing areas. What happens when salt water begins to intrude upon these growing areas?
Agriculture becomes very dicey. Obviously, the San Joaquin Valley is enormously threatened. 20 years ago, it was already recognized that there's salt creeping in. Once again, if sea level goes up a little, salt goes sideways a whole lot. And if any sort of salt within your soil reduces productivity and ends to the point that you can no longer grow crop plants. So this San Joaquin Valley itself is in danger. The northern Sacramento Valley is in trouble. And as I mentioned earlier, every delta on the planet and all that rice from Southeast Asia, those are the targeted places that we should worry about most agriculturally.
Okay, and well, let's be very specific. I live in Manhattan. Manhattan is a little bit above sea level. The place where I am is about, I don't know, 15, 20 feet above sea level. However, certain parts of Manhattan are very close to sea level. Wall Street, for example. So what is Manhattan going to look like, and are we going to have to use a system of dikes to prevent the flooding of Manhattan?
Yeah, there will have to be some sort of mitigation going on in Manhattan. If not for the sea level rise itself, certainly for the storm surge. Again, a small level storm surge is the takeoff point for, or I'm sorry, a small level sea level rise is the takeoff point for storm surge. And in my book, I actually did some elevation counts for various areas and various streets in New York. And not off the top of my head, I actually projected winners and losers in mm-hmm. New York City and its boroughs.
Okay, and let's talk about Venice. Engineers have seriously looked at the problem of Venice. San Marco Plaza, the famous plaza, is actually underwater for parts of the year. So what have we learned by trying to do these gigantic engineering projects like for Venice?
Well, Venice is really interesting because they're putting out into the bay that Venice faces what is sort of a non-traditional dike in a way. It's not like a single wall that the little Dutch boy can put his finger in. But what is interesting and sort of alarming for Venice is also in Holland, it's not just the sea level rise, but it's the fact that the river is behind yourself. These big cities were often built upon rivers. And because we've got global warming, it's not snowing in many of the mountains, in the Alps and in the Sierra, for instance. Snow level is higher. And so instead of snowing in the winter, it rains, and these rivers rise at times they never used to rise before. So Venice is fighting a two-front war, as is many of the Dutch cities. You have to worry about the river that runs through you as much as the sea coming at you. And as any of the military geniuses said, two-front wars are often hard to win.
So Venice may have to be abandoned at some point, you figure?
I would suspect, yes.
Okay, and your book goes beyond 2100, goes to 2300 and beyond. So what is the coastline of the world going to look like now beyond 2100? If I have a map of the world, what will school children see? The North Pole gone, the coastline changing. What will the Earth look like beyond 2100?
Well, it really boils down to some simple geology. Continents, as we know, move around. In the direction that they move, like North America's west coast, there are high mountains generally. But trailing edges, we call them passive edges, don't have mountains, or they have mountains that eroded away, as our east coast does. So you've got the enormous Gulf Plain, you've got the enormous east coast plain in front of the Appalachians. There'll be inroads all through that. The problem that we see is that most estimates and models think up to 2100 and stop. But at 2100, if it's business as usual, say we kept it at 3 feet, it doesn't stop there. It keeps going in accelerated fashion. So if you have 3 to 5 feet by 2100, it's not going to mean that you would have twice that by 2200. You could have three times that high. The acceleration is the most ominous aspect of this business.
So let's just do a computer program. Assume that at some point we stop greenhouse gases into the future, but we just let the computer program run. What will the world look like? Will all the great cities be underwater by then, by 2200, 2300?
No, ice sheets in Antarctica, they are thinning, and they're thinning in both Greenland and Antarctica. A great deal of that water is going in, but the ice sheets are enormously thick in both places. Greenland is far more endangered than Antarctica is. You're not going to see wholesale flooding of the cities by 2200 or even 2300, which possibly gives us time, but you're certainly going to see effects where the cities that will have to be abandoned, I think that will already be taking place. We just have to maintain these ice sheets with as much integrity as we can, and that means slowing the global warming temperatures, which seem to be inexorable. Look, we just went through this huge recession. We should have had 2 or 3 years because of the economic downturn, when emissions could have been or should have been reduced, they weren't. I mean, they're right up at the IPCC's maximum emission prediction. We're not lowering emissions. We're increasing emissions.
Okay, now let's go into the past. You can do that because we can drill into the ice cap and get ice cores from thousands of years ago. 10,000 years ago, we had the Ice Age. It was very cold 10,000 years and beyond that. So how far back in time do you have to go to find a time similar to what we're going to be experiencing in the future? And what did the world look like at that time?
Well, the conventional answer is that if we get up to 1,000 parts per million, which would happen in 2 centuries from now, if we have some sort of control on emissions, a lot of us think that 1,000 parts per million would be a lot sooner than that. But you're going all the way back to a time called the Eocene. And the Eocene was a very interesting time when we had crocodiles up on the North Pole. We had palm trees in Seattle. We just had this wonderfully tropical climate. The bad news is that sea level was 240 feet higher than it is now because there was no ice. There were no ice sheets at all on the planet.
And when was that?
This was about 50 million years ago, mm-hmm. but we only have to go back 110,000 years ago to see a world where sea level was at least 10 feet higher than now. Mm-hmm. And there's great evidence of this in Florida. In the Florida Keys, there's a beautiful quarry in Windley Key. It's a national park. And you can see big coral heads sitting 4 or 5 feet above sea level. Now, if you go offshore with your mask and flippers, you find the same corals, big Montastria they're called, living down about 10 feet deep. That's the shallowest they can live. So here is evidence, and we can date these with radiometric dating, that 105, 110,000 years ago, sea level was 10 feet higher than it is now, and the entire geography of that place was different. What caused that short-term rise, and this was a blip in the Ice Age, was orbital changes, but at the same time, we had a slight increase in carbon dioxide, and these two conspired to cause a great melt enough to produce a 10-foot rise in sea level.
Uh-huh, 10-foot rise in sea level. So the ice caps, they disappeared 150,000 years ago?
Well, we have very little fossil record of what an ice cap shape looked like because mm-hmm. it's floating ice. It doesn't leave any record of itself in sedimentary rock. But we have pretty good evidence on if there's an ice sheet because of the scratches and striations that moving ice produces. You can date some of these surfaces and get an idea about the direction of the ice and even in many cases the thickness of the ice depending on how deep the grooves were.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a pretty good sense of when there was ice and when there wasn't.
Okay. Well, now let's talk about mass migrations and how that could affect world politics. We've had Peter Schwartz of the Global Business Network on our show, and Peter Schwartz is a consultant for the United States Pentagon. And the Pentagon asked the Global Business Network a very simple question. What does global warming mean for the military? What kinds of military conflicts could arise because of global warming? And they looked at the maximum case, and the maximum case shows that you could have mass migrations of not just a million, but tens of millions, maybe even hundreds of millions of people. Look at the situation in Bangladesh, for example. And at that point, national borders could begin to crumble. How do you stop 10 million people from crawling all over your national borders? And what will nations do at that point? At that point, according to the Global Business Network, nations may reach for nuclear weapons to preserve the integrity of their national borders. And they specifically looked at certain hotspots where we have two opposing nuclear powers, and then the question of what happens when borders disintegrate. So what do you think?
Well, the unfortunate thing, I never knew about the Peter Schwartz report, but 2 years ago when I started writing this book, I actually put a 5-page scenario of exactly that, of Bangladesh really collapsing under not just the fact that much of it was being inundated by salt water, but once again, it's that pesky lateral movement. It's not just that they won't have a place to live, it's that the crops fail. I mean, Bangladesh feeds itself now, but barely. But they're projected to have a gigantic population rise. At the same time, they're going to lose this 3-crop rotation per year. And so my scenario certainly sees Bangladeshis pushing into India and India pushing back militarily. Actually, I got this scenario not from the Pentagon, but the CIA several years ago did a very similar sort of assessment. And they, I think, quite presciently said, yes, sea level rise is going to cause migration of borders. One aspect of it that you may not think about right off the bat is sea level rise is going to affect not only coastal cities and coastal agriculture, but much of the transportation corridors on land occur right near or at sea level. Transportation lines, major highways, lots and lots of rail lines, these things will go out very quickly because of storm surge. So when you're talking about mass migration now, if we're the case where sea level is producing mass migration, we're probably in a world where the normal transportation infrastructure has been highly degraded, let's put it that way.
And what about megacities? If you take a look at population rise, it's not uniform across the world. More and more peasants are leaving the farms, going into the gigantic megacities, creating gigantic mega slums, and of course, they're next to the water. So what happens when they get flooded? Where are they going to go? We're talking about hundreds of millions of people potentially being pushed out of their new home. What's going to happen then?
Well, because most megacities are surrounded in one case or another by at least small to large farmlands. I mean, it's, traditionally it was the case where you had the city, you had the farms surrounding it. Agricultural land will be inundated with humans, and this just exacerbates the problem of feeding ourselves. We're really looking at a case where, look, the elephant in the room is just too many people on this planet. It's just at this stage we have to deal with the idea that the human population can continue to do as it's doing unimpeded. Whatever happened to zero population growth, that movement in the 70s that said slow down, that has disappeared entirely, and that is the single most important part of the equation.
Okay, now that we've painted a picture of what our children, our grandkids, and our great-great-grandkids may face, then the question is, well, what are they going to say when they look back at us? What did we do to prevent this disaster from happening? So do you have any positive thoughts about what could be done, or is it inevitable?
No, actually, there's quite a bit of hope. Look, let's go back 5 years. Global warming was certainly a topic, but I would bet that you would have a hard time finding a single person on the planet now who hasn't heard in one language or another those two words strung together and have a sense of the implications. There has been an enormous amount of work to get the information out. I have to take a shot at journalists because journalism now is really based on this idea that you have a pro and a con, that every story has to have the negative side. And what makes me laugh is I can imagine somebody now doing an interview about gravity, and here's Isaac Newton, and the anti-gravity side says this. We really have to continue the sense that the word has to get out. And what I find most hopeful is I teach college kids, their generation gets it, their generation is worried, and their generation is doing things about it. And that's my sense of it, that we are going to get a hold of this thing, that we're going to find better and more alternative energy sources. We have to get off the coal habit. They keep saying we're addicted to oil, but the addiction to coal is way worse, way, way worse. And that coal is the cheapest form of energy on our planet, and it is, in a sense, centuries' worth is there. It's not like peak oil. Peak coal is centuries away.
Now, the Chinese are building one coal plant per week. Every week, a new coal plant is created in China. And to be fair, they're also creating solar panels as well. But what's going to replace coal, even if we reduce our dependency on oil, even though we go electric? Electric cars get their electricity from coal. So electric cars, in some sense, make it worse because they get their energy from coal. So what's going to replace coal?
Well, hopefully we have many things. There's not going to be any one single thing. And we're going to have to, again, I hold my nose, embrace nuclear. We're going to have to hope and pray that the experiments taking place in Berkeley, in the labs there for fusion reactors, work. I mean, if we can harness fusion power, boy, we're in great shape. But I think what we're going to have to find are enormous changes in lifestyle. Let's take one. We really need to erase airplane travel the way it is now. Airplanes are horrible polluters. You know, what's wrong with airships, lighter-than-air airships? What's wrong with staying home for vacation? And we scientists, we're among the worst. You know, we flip from place to place, from conference to conference. What about nice old sailing ships. You know, I bring up these ideas and people laugh at me, but can you imagine a beautiful stateroom? You've got your Wi-Fi and you've got your computer and you take 5 days to get to your conference. Things have to slow down. Things have to centralize. We need to have old-fashioned medieval cities, centralized, compressed living, circled by farms. The food you produce around you is the food you eat. That is the model for how to survive. What is the next? The big danger is the next 2 centuries. The big danger is the next century, really, with this pulse in human population.
And what reaction have you gotten? A lot of snickers and a lot of eyes rolled to the ceilings when you talk about a lifestyle of the Middle Ages?
Well, they call me Cassandra, and I get this Chicken Little over and over and over. I tried to do an op-ed piece for the New York Times, and they wrote back saying, well, we're not going to print this. And I said, why not? So, well, it's not that we don't believe you. It's just that it's such a horrible fate that it's just not going to happen. Okay, why not? Well, it's just it can't because it's too terrible. So why scare people? Even if it's going to happen, it's too terrible. So it won't happen.
They actually said that to you?
Yeah, written. I mean, just said, nope, can't do this.
So if it's too terrible, it's not going to happen because it's too terrible.
Exactly. And that's pretty much what I get from most of this conversation.
And last question. If you were to estimate or take a guess as to the most likely scenario, we painted, of course, a worst-case scenario and temperatures keep on rising and so on and so forth. But if you were to then say what is the most likely scenario, what would you say?
I say the population peaks at 9 billion, goes back down to 7 and 6. I say that emissions go up to about 600, and then we bring it back down to the mid-400s.
And why do they go down again? Things don't go down for nothing.
Well, they go down because if we can reduce population, they certainly will go down. And if we can increase the efficiency of power plants, if we can bring in the solar, bring in all these possibilities, yes, they will go down. But I do think we're going to have a case where sea level, in my own estimation, sea level will certainly hit 5 or 6 feet above what it is now, and hopefully doesn't go any higher than that.
Okay, and maybe our properties will be underwater by then.
Well, if you have a view property now, it'll be a waterfront property. And if you have a waterfront property now, you could make it an underwater park.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, you've been listening to our special guest, Professor Peter Ward, Professor of Biology and Earth and Planetary Science at the University of Washington in Seattle. The book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Good day.